sound from the transmission broke up the fight, and probably had something to do with one or more of our many breakdowns. The tour after that was a winter run to Texas with a different guy named Scott on drums, and my friend Dave Allen filling in as our singer. We were on stage playing in Dallas on New Year's Eve, and Chelsea was frantically yelling and signaling to me from the side of the stage. She was pointing at her face, which seemed all red, and then pointing at some guy next to her. I attempted to read her lips. "He hit me." I instinctively yanked off my guitar, ran across the stage, and pounced on the guy. I knocked him to the ground, and we traded punches as we rolled off the stage onto the floor. He ended up on top of me, but Mike tore through the tangled crowd to pull the guy off. "You fucker, you hit my girlfriend."
"No, I didn't."
"Chelsea, what happened?" She clarified, "He kissed me." I ended up being angrier at Chelsea than I was at the guy. She and I argued for the rest of the night. I don't remember if we finished our set. The worst, though, was a show in Bakersfield when Chelsea picked a fight with some girl who looked at her the wrong way. They started shoving each other. Then the girl's boyfriend put his hands on Chelsea. Again, instinct took over. I threw a single punch and broke the guy's nose. He cupped his hands to his face, and they quickly filled with blood. What the fuck did I just do? My anger instantly sublimated into remorse. "Oh, fuck, I'm going to get you some ice." Somebody grabbed me. "Leave him alone. You hurt him enough already." I got some ice anyway. Someone told me later that the guy was an asshole, and this wasn't the first time his nose had been broken at a show, but it didn't matter. What was this girl doing to me? And why was I letting her do it? It was time to break up. And then she told me she was pregnant. We had a long talk about what to do. I was 19, she was 17, and we're both still living with our parents. We didn't know anything about raising a kid. We barely understood that breaking random people's noses was not an appropriate way to spend a Saturday evening. It was like in Fast Times at Ridgemont High, $200 and a ride, except I paid the total for the abortion and waited for her at the clinic. 40 minutes after her appointment began, she came out crying. She told me about the blood that came out and how they told her to expect more bleeding in the future. The weight of the experience finally pushed our relationship to the breaking point, but it also bonded us. We remained friends after breaking up, and we still talk from time to time. She has a family of her own now. One of her three kids is even a NoFX fan. I can't imagine how different both of our lives would be if she had kept that kid. In all likelihood, NoFX would only be remembered by a single, awful 7-inch record, or more realistically, not remembered at all. Because my priorities would have been elsewhere. I would have gotten a shitty job and settled into a routine of constant fighting and living in fucking Rosemead. And we still probably would have eventually broken up. I never told my parents about any of it. And yet again, the band will be hearing this story for the first time here. It was another heavy secret that I hoisted onto my shoulders and carried around for years.
Chapter 21, Mike. When my friend Noah was nearly stabbed to death, I realized it was probably time for me to leave L.A. Noah was more of a casual punk fan. He was on the Beverly Hills High football team and not really involved with the scene. But he and I went together to see the Dickies at the Music Machine in Santa Monica just before NoFX went on our summer tour. I guess he stuck out from the rest of the crowd because some suicidals zeroed in on us outside the show. My suicidal friend Bruno stepped in and vouched for us, so I thought we were in the clear. I went inside, but Noah stayed outside, and a little while later, another friend came up to me and said, "Dude, your friend's out there. He's fucked up." I went outside and discovered Noah on the ground with blood squirting out of his chest. Apparently the suicidals fucked with him again, so he took off running, and they chased him down like feral dogs. I helped load him into Eddie Machtinger's car, and Eddie drove him to the hospital. He had been stabbed in the lung. The doctors were barely able to save his life, and he never played football again. Around the same time, I was sitting outside the cafe during a show, and some gangsters were beating up some random Mohawk dude in a parking lot about 100 feet away. It was the typical nightly 20-on-1 scuffle until someone jumped on the Mohawk guy's neck. The crowd around him froze, and then everyone scattered. The guy just lay there limp on the asphalt. I liked punk rock, and I liked being in a band, but I didn't like the idea of getting killed over it. It had become far too normal to go to a show and have someone walk up and say, "Oh, by the way, they took your friend to the hospital." I was going to college one way or the other. Even though my parents weren't religious, they were still Jewish. And in a Jewish family, it's not, "Are you going to college?" It's, "Which college are you going to?" I had been accepted to USC and San Francisco State, so when I saw my chance to move north, I took it. I majored in social science with a minor in human sexuality and met a girl named Wendy. Her dad was a rich dude, but he decided at some point to stop paying her college expenses, so she moved into my dorm room soon after we started dating. She became a bike messenger to cover her tuition, and we ended up moving into a house with some of her new colleagues. Being a bike messenger is less of a job and more of a lifestyle. We had 6 or 8 people living with us. I'm not sure if you count the one who got busted selling acid through the mail and went to jail for 20 years. And they all partied constantly. I have a lot of fond memories from those days. Once, Wendy dragged me to see the Red Hot Chili Peppers at San Jose University, and we couldn't find parking. We stole a parking pass from a van with an open window, and feeling mischievous, stole a suitcase from the back of the van as well. When we got home, we opened the case to find a hat with a whale sticking out of it, an American flag kilt, and some leather waiter pants. These were the outfits that Chili Peppers had worn in all their promo photos and on stage for their whole Freaky Styley tour. They were known for their goofy costumes, and I had wondered why that night they chose to perform in just jeans and t-shirts. I wore the whale hat, and Wendy wore the kilt for a while, but eventually everything got lost or disappeared. Which is a shame, because all that stuff would probably be pretty valuable now. I know that story has very little to do with the history of NoFX. I just love the idea of one of the Chili Peppers reading this book and finally learning what became of those outfits. Hi, guys. Things with Wendy went south after she had a couple of nasty accidents on her bike. She cracked her head open during one of them, and her behavior took a sharp turn toward crazy. She was angry and moody all the time, and she constantly picked fights with me. One day, I found a note on my van. Some girl named Erin Kelly saw that I had NoFX spray-painted on the side of my van and knew that NoFX was playing in Santa Barbara that weekend. She asked if she might be able to hitch a ride south to meet a friend. Erin would later describe this as the most uncomfortable drive of her life, because Wendy and I blasted music at top volume to try to cover up the fact that we were arguing the whole trip. Erin chose to purchase a bus ticket back to San Francisco rather than ride with us again. The final straw with Wendy was at a verbal abuse show in Berkeley. We went with a group of 7 friends, and I managed to get 5 people in for free. But 2 of Wendy's friends couldn't get in, so she was furious that they had to pay the $5 cover. She kept screaming at me, and I kept walking away from her. I had just finished a 40-ouncer of Old English, and the moment I opened a second one, she knocked the bottle out of my hand. Without thinking, I slapped her. I flashed back to the time I cowered away from hitting Natalie for fear of being beaten to death, and wondered if now my time had come. And then my friend Jerry said, 10 points, dude, and everyone started laughing. She had made such a spectacle of herself that no one judged me for lashing out, but she was upset and started shouting, "I can't see, I'm blind!" Erin happened to be at the show, so she went to help Wendy. Wendy asked, "Who is this?" And Erin replied, "It's Erin." Wendy punched Erin in the stomach and said, "You're the cause of all my problems." Wendy was convinced I was cheating on her with Erin, which wasn't the case. Erin and I had become friends after I apologized for the 6-hour hell ride to Santa Barbara, but it was purely platonic. When I found out she liked to get tied up and whipped during sex, however, I mentally moved her into the dateable column. After Wendy and I broke up, I ended up living in my van for 4 months. Some might consider this a hardship, but it was awesome. I would park in front of friends' houses, have dinner and drinks with them, and then lie in my van and write songs while listening to the rain hit the roof. I would go to night class, have a few drinks, and pass out, and then I'd wake up the next morning, and I'd already be at school. I loved the solitude of it. No one could bug me. It was just like that Descendants song. It was the only time in my life when I lived completely alone. I always had roommates before that, and as school ended, I moved in with the woman who I would eventually move from the dateable column into the marryable column. NoFX was still technically a band while I was in college, but Scott quit after our summer tour and Melvin was still living in L.A., so we weren't practicing much. As my first semester was ending, Melvin called and said he found a drummer and a singer and taught them our songs. Without meeting either one of them, without ever fucking practicing together once, we went on a 7-date tour through Texas over winter break. Our first time ever playing music together in the same room was at our first show in El Paso. The new singer, Dave Allen, stood completely still on stage. He didn't say a word between songs, and he couldn't keep the lyrics straight. Our new drummer, Scott Aldahl, was terrible, too. Combine that with zero practice and the fact that we sucked in the first place, and you can imagine how well we were received by the crowd. We played New Year's Eve at a club called the Twilight Room in Dallas. We had played to a bunch of people at a skate park in Dallas on our summer tour, so the promoter figured we were a good draw. The truth was that at the skate park, people were just there to skate and were doing their best to ignore us. So now, sounding worse than before, we were headlining New Year's Eve and ruining everyone's night. People booed, and Melvin got into a fight with some local skinhead. I think the skinhead threw something or gave Melvin the finger, or maybe Melvin's girlfriend Chelsea started it, since she was along for the ride. But the guy Melvin socked had friends, and the show immediately turned into a full-on skinhead riot. The owner of the club pulled out a shotgun and fired around into the ceiling. Everyone scattered. We didn't finish our set. Happy New Year, 1986. Nothing went right on that tour. During one of the drives, I was sleeping in the back of the van when I awoke to some strange noise. A moment later, a huge pickup truck smashed into us. The driver had fallen asleep at the wheel. The area of the van where I had been laying my head was completely crushed. We were towed to a truck stop and had to sleep in the van until the next morning. It was so cold that the condensation from our breath formed sheets of ice on the van ceiling. When we woke up, the ice was melting. It was raining inside our van. It was like a black cloud was literally over our heads. When we got home, I didn't even say goodbye to Dave, which I sort of regret because it was the last time I'd ever see him alive. A few months after the tour, he rolled his pickup truck and crashed into a tree. His passenger got out and called an ambulance, but the steering wheel had slammed into Dave's body, causing severe internal injuries. He died at the hospital later that night.
Chapter 22. Smelly. On my first night of living independently from my parents, my roommate told me how he'd strangled someone to death in the desert. I was dating a girl named Gail. She was from the right side of the tracks and going to college at UC Santa Barbara. I was from the wrong side of the tracks and feigning interest in Santa Barbara City College so I would have an excuse to follow her out of LA after graduating high school. She moved into the dorms, and I moved into a house with some random people I found in the classifieds. I shared my room with a skinny blonde guy named Jeff, and while we were settling into bed that first night, we were talking, with the lights out, about how we both loved taking acid. I casually mentioned that I used to deal drugs a bit in high school, and he casually mentioned that he used to deal, too. And that one time, someone ripped him off, and he took revenge by beating the guy up, tossing him in his trunk, driving him out to the middle of the desert, and strangling him to death with a rope while he and his friends took mushrooms. My blood ran cold. Who the fuck was I living with? Jeff and I ended up hanging out quite a bit and became pretty good friends over the next few months. Nice guy. College and I, however, were not a good fit. I left classes early or skipped them altogether. I had the best intentions of getting an education, but I just couldn't handle it. In my 40s, I was diagnosed with ADHD. I'm pretty sure I have dyslexia. I lucked out, finding a career that didn't require a college degree. When I wasn't in school, I had an office job processing orders in some shipping and receiving department. But after about 6 months, I had broken up with Gail, dropped out of school, and lost the job. I was back to selling acid and playing drums. I met another punk in one of my classes, and together we formed a band called Antikrieg, with two of his ridiculously rich friends. Santa Barbara was a wealthy area, so half of the punk scene was comprised of kids from mega-rich families. Antikrieg's guitarist lived in a $6 million home perched on a cliff overlooking the ocean in a neighborhood called Hope Ranch, which is apparently one of the wealthiest areas in the state. Snoop Dogg currently has a house there. Adjusting for inflation in the California real estate market, it would probably be worth $20 or $30 million today. And then his family moved into an even more insane house with a koi pond that ran from the outside of the house under these huge glass walls into the house, where the pond and a swimming pool coexisted in this massive atrium area. It was the exact opposite of punk, but it wasn't that unusual in Santa Barbara. Antikrieg built up a following fast. We got to a point where we could easily draw a few hundred people to a local show. Then the bass player got cancer and had to undergo chemotherapy. And later, the singer dissolved the group. After Anticrieg broke up, he drove NoFX to shows in his van a few times. Once he was driving, and a big clump of his hair fell out. It blew out the open driver's side window, and then blew back into the van and landed on my lap. Just before Anticrieg broke up, I ran into Melvin's ex-girlfriend Chelsea and Melvin's mom on State Street. Chelsea said I should call Eric because NoFX's singer had died, and their drummer had either quit or was about to get kicked out. I made the call, and I was back in NoFX. We jammed a bit, went into the studio and recorded our second EP, and hit the road that summer for my first U.S. tour. Bumping into Melvin's mom and Chelsea that one afternoon was such a random, unexpected, and unlikely encounter, and yet without it, I never would have ended up back in the band. At the time, I was alone, with no band, no degree, and no job. I probably would have tried to make a go of it as a full-time drug dealer, or ended up ODing, or going to prison. Or maybe I would have ended up strangled and buried in the desert.
Chapter 23, Melvin. The first time we played Detroit, four people paid $1 each to see us and then left as soon as we started playing. When we played Detroit on our 86 tour with Smelly back on drums, four different people showed up to see us and actually stayed, but only because they were friends with the guy who booked the show, Scary Carrie. At the end of the night, Scary Carrie took us to his apartment, which was on the second floor above a pawn shop, surrounded by barbed wire and accessorized with a grumpy bulldog and a shotgun propped against the back door. His AC unit blew only the most tepid air, so we left the windows open to deal with the oppressive summer heat. Trucks were coming and going from the nearby industrial park all night, so the AC unit sucked all the diesel fumes directly into his tiny living room. When we arrived at the apartment, Scary Carrie made us a big pasta dinner. As we ate, he said, "Hey, you want to see some crazy shit?" He stuck a tape in his VCR and hit play. On his television screen, there appeared a close-up of a man's face, looking up, mystified by some point of wonder just off-screen. Then a woman's ass entered the frame and squeezed a huge log of shit into the protagonist's open mouth. Dinner was over.
Chapter 24, Mike. A friend of ours graffitied NoFX in huge letters on the side of our van before the 86 tour, and we spray-painted squares on the tires so it looked like the van had square wheels. Did you know spray-paint eats rubber? We didn't, until the second of our four blowouts. The graffiti also made us a cop magnet. We were pulled over and searched in Syracuse, New York, and the cop found a billy club we had stolen from a party somewhere. He said we were in possession of a deadly weapon and one of us had to take the rap or he was going to arrest us all, so I took the fall. I sat in a holding cell for 8 hours, bored out of my fucking mind. I actually jerked off around 5 a.m. because I was alone with nothing else to do. I called my mom to ask for bail, but it was in the middle of the night in California, so she just went back to sleep and waited until the morning to call a bondsman. Around 10 a.m., they transferred me to an actual jail, where I spent the afternoon playing spades with a table full of bikers. And winning, I might add. I made bail around 5 p.m. and met up with the rest of the band, who had no idea when they might see me again. We had a show in Springfield, Massachusetts, with the band Subculture that night, so we floored it the whole way there. It turned out to be the biggest show of the tour. 200 people showed up, and Subculture sold $150 worth of merch. We, however, showed up too late to play. The first time we met Subculture on the road, I was a scrawny kid, but the next time we saw them, I had gained some weight, thanks to my unlimited college meal plan. I don't know if I'd call myself fat at 160 pounds, but one of the guys from Subculture started calling me Fat Mike. And to this day, everyone's still confused by it.
Chapter 25, Melvin. When NoFX started, I considered myself straight edge. The LA punk scene was so fucked up and full of gangster drug addicts. The positive, no drugs, no drinking message of the original straight edge movement resonated with me. And alcohol just made me sleepy, so it was easy to do without it. That didn't last long because beer is easier to come by than water on a punk tour, but it wasn't until my mid-20s that I really took up booze as a hobby. Even then, I was dissuaded a bit after spending a night puking in someone's garden somewhere on tour. In the meantime, I was redefining straight edge to allow for open experimentation with any other drug that came my way. I smoked my friend's parents' weed as a kid, took mushrooms in Ashland on tour, and when Chelsea's brother offered me a sherm outside the Olympic Auditorium one night, I went for it. It looked like a normal cigarette to me. I didn't know sherm meant that it had been dipped in liquid PCP. I wasn't a smoker, but it seemed like a good way to bond with my girlfriend's brother and his FFF gangster buddies. So after he took a hit, I took one too. The sherm went around the circle. Chelsea's brother and I both took our second hits. And when I turned back around to talk to him, he was on the ground, passed out. Then it hit me. I must have collapsed because people kept telling me to get to my feet. There's cops over there. If they see you this fucked up, they're going to take you to jail. The anxiety didn't help the spinning, nor did the milk someone handed me. I drank it and puked it back up instantly and then ran for cover. I walked into a wall, fell on my ass, held my hands on my head, and curled up as small as I could to try to make myself invisible. Every time I opened my eyes, I felt like I was on an out-of-control carousel that was actively trying to throw me off. And every time I tried to stand up, I fell back down. Mike found me, and I guess I blurted out some explanation of what had happened. He couldn't do much except sit with me and wait for it to pass. And like a good friend, that's what he did. Mike usually just focused on beer, while I focused on hallucinogens. I dropped acid for the first time while he and I were at a Halloween party in the valley. The Grim was playing, and the drummer was dressed like Eddie Munster, but the acid convinced me it was the real Eddie Munster playing drums. After their set, I spent the whole party tripping out on the shapes the moonlight was making in the ripples of the swimming pool, and the shadows made by the leaves on the lawn. I got caught up in the idea that the shadows were just as real as the leaves themselves, and I was somehow able to flip a switch in my brain that would either allow me to only see the leaves or only see their shadows. Later, Mike got drunk enough to co-conspire with me to steal the police billy club that we kept in the NoFX van, and which later earned him a night in jail. Mike never messed with cocaine until he was in his 30s, but coke entered the picture for me right along with acid, PCP, and everything else. When I first met our temporary singer, Dave Allen, I went to hang out with him at a mutual friend's house and discovered they were running a moderately successful cocaine-dealing enterprise out of his friend's garage. A handful of punkers were cutting and mixing powder, weighing it on a scale, and packing it into bindles while listening to records. I offered to pitch in, and it became my job to fold the bindles. They never ordered me or paid me to do it, but hey, while I'm hanging out, why not donate some free labor to their drug racket? Before I ever snorted any coke, Dave offered me a Cocoa Puff, which is a cigarette that has been tamped down so the tobacco recedes inside the paper a bit and cocaine fills in the gap. It stood out from all the other drugs I'd done by offering a rush instead of a mellow or psychedelic high. It would be years until I tried coke again. But I chased the rush by seeking out any other go-fast drug I could find, which led me to speed. I found a regular dealer who sold me cheap, black and red capsules that he called Bloody Niggers. I would go to a punk show, snap one open, snort the contents, and slam dance all night long. It became my routine for a few months, until one night I went home and I couldn't sleep despite being overwhelmed with exhaustion. My legs cramped up, and I was covered in sweat as I watched the sun come up through my window. After that, I gave drugs a break for a while, except for acid and mushrooms and lots of weed. That still counts as straight edge, right?
Chapter 26, Mike. It took me years to figure out why my mom had a mirror on the ceiling over her bed. When I was 12, I watched TV in her room and thought, cool, I can see myself. It finally clicked when I was staying at Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas in my 20s. Oh, this is for watching yourself fuck. My mom had one of these. Oh. I have a mirror above my own bed now. My daughter, Darla, recently saw it and said, this is so cool. You can wake up in the morning and see yourself. And the circle goes round. My mom never remarried after my parents' divorce. but she had a French boyfriend for about 8 years. He was the one who suggested they install the mirror. But I'm not sure if he or my mom should be credited for my first exposure to S&M porn. Penthouse Variations is sort of like a Reader's Digest for people into flogging and nipple clamps. It's mostly stories, supposedly submitted by readers, about kinky sex. I dug up a copy while snooping through my mom's stuff. Her copies of Hustler and Cocks and Cunts never did much for me, but the stories of male submission in that issue of Penthouse Variations gave me my first boner. There was a story about a dominant wife who cross-dressed her husband and treated him like a slave, even allowing her friends to come over and rape him. Pretty intense stuff for a 13-year-old to read, but I must have jerked off to it like 100 times. I would forever associate female supremacy with eroticism. It's shaped my sexuality and has been a crucial component of all my relationships. Natalie and I choked each other during sex, and she would scratch my back until it bled. Wendy turned the leather waders we stole from the Red Hot Chili Peppers into a bondage hood, and between the two there was Cindy. Cindy was the host of the house party that Dylan, Melvin, and I played as a three-piece at the dawn of NoFX. I had no plans to make a move on her because Melvin had a crush on her, and I was already hitting on another girl that night, but Cindy walked up to me at the party and started making out with me, so I ended up with the two girls, and Melvin had none. Melvin was bitter about that, but he kept it to himself, at least until one night at the Stardust Ballroom. Cindy and I were fucking in the parking lot between two parked cars. People kept walking by and looking at us, and Cindy was lying in a puddle of piss, so we decided to change locations. We crawled inside Melvin's station wagon, finished fucking, and passed out. After the show, Melvin found us naked and asleep. "What the fuck are you doing?" "Well, I knew the window wasn't there, and it was seemed like a good place to have sex." He chased me in circles around the car. He was yelling, "You're gonna fuck the girl I have a crush on?" And I was yelling, "Don't hit me!" After a few laps, I couldn't help but laugh at the fact that he couldn't catch me. Then Melvin started laughing too. I don't know if that same scene would have played out the same with any two other people, but we left that show as friends. Cindy and I only dated for a month, but that was the month when I first got my hands on some actual SM equipment. Cindy's dad had been a CIA agent, so their garage was full of cool old spy machines. One day we were digging through the lie detectors and code breakers, or whatever they were, and found a box of homemade leather sex toys. It wasn't the sleek black SM gear you see in sex shops. It was all tan leather with uneven stitching. Her dad had clearly taken some care to learn leathercraft to fashion whips and body harnesses in his spare time. We played with the whips, but couldn't figure out how to fit into the body harness. The biggest mystery, however, was a butt plug with a hole through the middle and a length of plastic tubing running out of it. We figured it was some kind of crazy enema device, but we thought it would make a rad beer bong. We took it into the kitchen, scrubbed it with soap, and attached a funnel to the end of the tube. And as we poured the first beer and sucked it out of the butt plug end, Cindy's mom walked in. "Where did you get that?" "We found it in the garage." Mortified, she turned around and left. I don't think I ever saw her again. Sometime later, we were driving around and I got pulled over by a cop. Rightfully so, I was drunk from butt plug bonging. The cop looked at the back of the car and saw the plug and picked it up. I knew that I was busted. The cop says, "What is this?" And I said, "What does it look like?" Disgusted, he threw it down in the back seat. "Get the fuck out of here." When I started dating Erin, our first kinky experiment was on the road with NoFX. She and I borrowed the van one night for some private time after the show. We drove to an empty supermarket parking lot, and she tied me up and blindfolded me in the van, naked. She pulled out a whip, but just as things were getting good, a police car pulled into the lot. I couldn't see. I just heard her yell, "Fuck!" "What?" "There's cops here." "Fuck!" They banged on the window, and Erin opened the door to reveal what I'm sure was later a riveting conversation piece back at the station. "Get the fuck out of here." We retreated to the house where everyone was staying that night. Sadly, we never got to finish, and I ended up with 2 mosquito bites on my nuts. That's not the kind of suffering I like. Even at home, it was tough to find privacy to explore. Erin and I moved in together right away and lived in a house on Page Street in San Francisco. At one point, our roommates were away, and we had the house to ourselves, so we really let loose. I was gagged, blindfolded, and tied up spread eagle on the bed. Erin left me there helpless while she went to take a shower. It was perfect, but then I heard a knock at the front door. And then I heard the door open. And then I heard someone walking up the stairs towards the bedroom. "Hello, this is Alex, the landlord." I would have happily responded had I not had a gag stuffed in my mouth. The door to the bedroom was wide open. The steps got closer, and then they stopped. I couldn't see anything with the blindfold on, but after a brief pause, I heard footsteps quickly going down the stairs and out the door. These days, I'm very open about my sexuality, but at the time, I was living in constant fear of being discovered as a fetishist. I was too embarrassed to even walk into an adult bookstore to buy SM porn. It wasn't until the late 80s that I was able to talk even a little about SM with my bandmates. After a tour date in Hamburg, I bought some leather restraints and a ball gag from a local sex shop. When we were going through customs at the Amsterdam airport, an official pulled everything out of my bag. I finally knew how Cindy's mom felt walking in on us with the butt bong several years prior. I wanted to disappear. But the customs guy didn't seem fazed at all. It was Amsterdam. They probably see stuff like that there all the time. Melvin and Smelly didn't seem to care either. They had probably picked up on my not-so-subtle lyrical references, for instance, naming an album S&M Airlines. That's when I realized I had nothing to be ashamed of. From then on, I didn't bother to hide who I was or what I enjoyed. If I wanted to wear a leather hood made of Hill Slovak's pants while my girlfriend shoved a beer bong butt plug up my ass in front of our landlord, so be it.
Chapter 27, Smelly. I came up with a plan to murder my friend. I would suggest that we'd go get a drink or try to score some drugs and lure him into my car. I would take him up into the mountains to get high, and I would shoot him and leave him there on the side of the road. It wouldn't be hard to get a gun. I knew enough sketchy people that would only take a phone call. The authorities probably wouldn't investigate too closely. They'd just chalk it up as a gang thing. It probably wasn't the most solid plan, but I needed to develop some sort of strategy, because I knew that, in the interest of survival, there might come a day when I would have to kill Raymond. Raymond isn't his real name, because even though it's been years since I've seen him, the guy still petrifies me. And even though he's been in and out of prison for every violent crime imaginable, I don't want to accidentally implicate him in anything new and give him a reason to seek vengeance. For the sake of you and I both sleeping better at night, let's just say I made the rest of this chapter up. There was a corner in Santa Barbara where all the punks congregated for long afternoons of doing nothing. Every once in a while, this scary-looking dude would come by and people would scatter. He looked like a white version of Mike Tyson, with slick back hair and prison tattoos covering his arms, neck, and back. He didn't have to say a word or move a muscle. He automatically instilled the deep sense of fear in anyone who crossed his path. Everyone whispered behind his back, "That Raymond dude is fucking gnarly." There were rumors around town that Raymond would kill bums and winos for fun. I can't confirm that personally, but I never had trouble believing it. A mutual criminal friend told me about a time when he and Raymond kidnapped a guy who owed Raymond $40. They tossed him in a trunk and were trying to decide what to do with him. Raymond says, "Fuck it, let's just kill him." My friend said, "Are you fucking kidding me? You're going to go to prison for life over $40? Raymond didn't see the problem. Ultimately, they just pounded the guy senseless, took his shoes, and dropped him off in the middle of nowhere. But my friend capped the story off with, "Yeah, Raymond liked to kill people." Once, my friend Lynn Strait, from the band Snot and now deceased, walked into a party, and Raymond bitch-slapped him in front of everyone for no reason. It was a domination thing in an Animal Kingdom sort of way, or more accurately, in a prison sort of way. He had spent 7 of his late teenage years in a California Youth Authority detention center for beating up a cop. I'm sure it had an effect on his sense of social etiquette. Lynn once loaned Raymond his car and later asked if he could have it back. Raymond bitch-slapped him again and told him he'd give it back when he was ready to give it back. He terrorized the city of punk rockers, and he was my best friend. Once again, I ran toward the thing that was supposed to scare me away. And once again, I found myself compensating for my own insecurity by trying to prove I was a badass. I befriended Raymond because he was a badge I could wear and a counterculture I could explore. I was working in a fabric store, and I knew they kept a couple $100 in a register overnight. So I told Raymond, we went down there with a couple of crowbars and tried to break in. The place was locked up tight. But we didn't want to go home without committing some sort of crime. So we climbed onto the roof of a nearby synagogue and broke in through the upstairs window. We found a safe, but couldn't get into it either. We looked through the drawers and the desks, but there was nothing worth taking. All we ended up with was a gallon of ice cream, which we sat and ate together in the synagogue's kitchen. I risked jail for a gallon of ice cream. Such was my need for acceptance. I became Raymond's sidekick, and we tooled around Santa Barbara hassling his enemies, breaking and entering, and taking shit whether someone was home or not. I knew one punker who had a nice guitar, so we broke into his house and stole it along with a box of cassette tapes. I thought the guitar was a Les Paul, but it turned out to be a cheap copy, so we smashed it. When I got home, I went through the cassettes and found a NoFX demo. I was trying hard to be a sociopath like Raymond, but I still knew right from wrong. Seeing the tape turned my stomach with guilt. I choked it down. Before I started hanging out with Raymond, the Cholo gangsters who lived up the street never bothered me. Now they were driving by my house and mad-dogging me because Raymond's Mexican half-brother was a shot caller with the Mexican mafia. And now I was on their radar. It was no joke. I remember hanging out at Raymond's half-brother's house. He had guns stashed under the couch, behind the TV, in the flower pots. There was hardly a spot in the house where a gun was not in arm's reach. Raymond and I lived on the west side of Santa Barbara. One day, we were hanging out at a coffee shop with some friends when some east side cholos walked in. Raymond was up on his feet in their faces. "What the fuck, puto? What are you doing in our neighborhood?" The gang banter went back and forth, but the east siders backed down and left. Then, an hour later, they came back with reinforcements. It was 20-on-10. They rushed us and started swinging. Raymond went into Incredible Hulk mode and bashed back every attacker. I don't know if I was hit by a fist or a bat or what, but something got me in the gut and it buckled me. I took a few kicks to the head while I was down, but the whole thing ended as quickly as it began. The East Siders had made their point. Our group was laid out flat. I looked up. Raymond was the only one left standing. Raymond was always left standing and usually hungry for more. Honestly, though, most of the time, he and I would just hang out and talk. I saw a gentle side of Raymond that no one else would have believed existed. We'd get high, talk about our aspirations, life, family, all that shit. He'd drop his persona and offered private moments of real vulnerability. It was heartbreaking, in a way. Deep down, deep, deep down, nice guy. But I still needed a plan to murder him. Regardless of what goodness lay inside, he was still a volatile sociopath who could turn on me at any moment. Through Raymond, I started to associate with more criminal types. I saw how they were totally cool one minute and callously beating the fuck out of someone the next. But with Raymond, it wouldn't be as simple as a harsh beating or a stab wound. Once he locked onto a target, he got off on mentally torturing his victims. He harassed them and fucked with them nonstop. He held people hostage in their own minds. It's one thing to beat someone up, take their money and run. It's another thing to walk into someone's house, pick up their TV and say, "What the fuck are you going to do about it?" and walk out laughing. He was a predator who fed on fear. There was a story going around about a kid who went along with Raymond on a bum hunting mission. Raymond allegedly killed a homeless guy in front of the kid and threatened to kill the kid if he talked. He was so relentless with his harassment that he never had to make good on his threats. The kid was so scared, he killed himself before Raymond got the chance. Thankfully, I never became one of Raymond's targets, but he did host one of the most frightening nights of my life. I went with Raymond to Oxnard to pick up his car from an acquaintance who had been repairing it. One of Raymond's friends gave us a ride to this ghetto housing project full of run-down tract homes built within a labyrinth of cul-de-sacs. Raymond's car was waiting, but so were a dozen menacing cholos. We had been set up. Raymond had pissed off someone, somehow, and it was time for payback. The cholo started in, "What the fuck, S.A.? What you gotta say now? You're in our fucking neighborhood." I don't know why they didn't kill us right there. If they were messing with Raymond, they had to know death was on the table, but miraculously, they let us go. "We're taking a car, Holmes. What the fuck you gonna do about it? Fuck you. Walk back to Santa Barbara." We walked out of the development and sat on a curb outside a gas station. Raymond was steaming. He didn't like the taste of his own medicine. "Go back there and see if they're still there. We'll steal the car." Classic no-win situation. Look like a pussy in front of a guy I'd been trying so hard to impress or confront a whole crew of pissed-off gangsters. I marched back into the development. Alone. The cholos saw me approaching. One guy picked up a big-ass screwdriver. Another guy grabbed a crowbar. "What the fuck you want, little kid? Fuck you, punk." I don't know what I said. All my energy was focused on keeping the piss and shit inside my body. But I backed away, found Raymond, and told him what happened. Fuck that. Let's go in and get him. Awesome. I'm gonna die now. This time they saw us coming from much farther away, and there was no more yelling or intimidation. They came at us, full speed. I turned around and ran, and Raymond was sensible enough to run with me. The Cholos hopped into a pickup truck and gave chase. We ducked into backyards and hopped fences to escape the maze of dead-end streets. But this was their turf. They knew every inch of it, so they were on our tail the whole time, and they kept cornering us. We hid under cars, behind bushes, trash cans as we ran from yard to yard. They knew where we were going before we did. We found a broom handle somewhere and broke it in two, so each of us had a weapon. But we weren't kidding ourselves about how much that would help if we were caught. For 2 straight hours, it was a real-life version of the Warriors. It was the most scared I'd ever been. We ended up in a yard that backed up to a freeway. The Cholos must have thought we hopped the fence and ran onto the freeway, because we saw them slowly driving up the on-ramp while we hid behind some bushes. We knew they couldn't turn around easily, so we bolted. We ran back to the gas station, and there was a cop there. It was probably the happiest Raymond had ever been to see a police officer. We didn't go into detail, but we explained we needed to ride out of there. He must have known we were in the wrong neighborhood, because he dropped us off 2 exits down the freeway without too many questions. We hitchhiked to Carpinteria and walked another 10 miles home to Santa Barbara. A month or so later, Raymond showed up at my house. It had looked like someone had taken a cheese grater to half his face. I knew he'd been down to Oxnard again, so I wondered if he had tangled with the Cholos. He said he jumped over a chain guarding a parking lot, hooked his foot on it, and fallen onto the cement. It sounded like a reasonable explanation. If he had been beaten down, he probably would have not only told me, but also enlisted me to get revenge. All I know for sure is that he never got his car back. If I hadn't rejoined NoFX and left for tour, I'm sure my friendship with Raymond would have eventually caught up to me. It certainly caught up to him. In 1989, he had the dubious distinction of being part of one of the first busloads of prisoners through the gates of Pelican Bay, the gnarliest prison in California, and easily one of the top 10 gnarliest in the country. Usually prisons are self-segregated by race. The Mexicans have their area, the blacks have theirs, etc. But since Pelican Bay was brand new, no one had claimed territory yet. So for the first few weeks, it was just free-for-all race riots while invisible lines were being drawn. And Raymond was right in the middle of it, probably standing tall while all the other criminals fell around him, or maybe finally meeting his match. What was it that finally landed him in jail? Rape. I lost touch with him before his arrest, so I'm fuzzy on the details, but from what I hear, he was in his 20s, she was 15. He said it was consensual. She said it wasn't. Supposedly, when the charges came out, a bunch of other girls came forward to say Raymond had raped them, too. After the judge handed down the sentence of 12 years, Raymond turned to his accusers and said, in open court, "When I get out of jail, I'm going to kill each and every one of you bitches." He showed up at a NoFX show after he served his time, with some brand new face tattoos and stab wounds. We caught up for a few minutes, but I haven't seen him since. He apparently pulled a gun on someone and went back to jail, then got out a few years later, and then went back in again for some crime that should have earned him his third strike and put him behind bars for life. But it turns out the rape charges were filed before the 3 strikes law went into effect in California. I just heard from a friend that he's out again. Like I said, you'll sleep better if you believe I just made all this up.
Chapter 28, Melvin. During one of our trips up to Idaho after Eric rejoined the band, I met an exotic, almond-eyed beauty named Iris. She had shoulder-length brown hair and the confidence and intelligence to match her looks. She had been to Europe and knew all about touring. She even spoke German, but she also had a German boyfriend, so I had to keep my hands to myself. Chelsea and I had broken up, and I'd moved to Santa Barbara and enrolled in psychology classes at City College. Smelly and I found a house to rent with some friends, which became the NoFX house. Normally, a punk house shared by several dudes in their early 20s would generate stories of chaos and epic parties, but in truth, it was a pretty mellow establishment. I was smoking way too much pot every day. so my roommates and I mostly sat around playing chess for 4 hours at a time. Someone would make a move, and then we'd both sit there thinking about the next 5 moves we were going to make, and then 15 minutes later, whose move is it? I don't know, dude. I thought it was yours. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Repeat. Aside from a few house parties and building a skate ramp in the backyard, the only chaotic moment that stands out in my memory is one Christmas when we brought in a tree and couldn't figure out how to dispose of it afterward. We stuffed the whole thing up the fireplace and set it on fire. I don't know how we didn't burn down the house. We all stood on the front lawn, cheering as we watched the flames leap from the top of the chimney. Iris and I kept in touch and wrote letters back and forth for a while, and my patience finally paid off. When her relationship with a German guy ended, she took a Greyhound down to Santa Barbara, while I drove 16 hours each way to Boise to pick up all her stuff and move her into the NoFX house. Iris came along on the second nationwide NoFX tour, but she nearly didn't make it back. We played at the Metroplex in Atlanta, Georgia, and behind the club were several sets of tracks leading to a nearby train yard. Growing up in a city, I was more used to traffic than trains, so I was fascinated watching the freight cars come and go all afternoon. I decided to get a closer look at one train as it crawled slowly along its track, and Iris came with me. She had heard about people putting pennies on the tracks and the trains flattening them, so she placed one under the slow train's wheels. We were on adjacent sets of tracks, waiting expectantly for this metal behemoth to flatten her penny, when we jumped at the ear-splitting sound of a train horn. We looked up to see a train coming toward us at top speed. Everything went into slow motion. Iris tried to run off the tracks back towards the club. My brain decided she didn't have enough time to clear the tracks, so I grabbed her arm and pulled her toward me, trapping us in the very narrow gap between the slow-moving train and the fast-moving one. My brain knew that the trains are meant to run next to each other, but not into each other, so we'd somehow be safe in that little space. There wasn't enough time for me to explain this logic to Iris, of course, nor to tell my brain that we were still in horrible danger of being decapitated or dismembered should either of those trains have any stray metal parts hanging off of them, or should we lean too far in either direction. Everything went back into fast motion as the highballing train barreled loudly past us, horn blaring and wind whipping. The gap was so tight we had to stand side by side as if we were standing on the narrow window ledge of a tall building. I was frozen with fear, focusing only on using my mental powers to somehow physically shrink both of us down to a smaller size. Iris probably wanted to scream, but neither of us could even breathe. I still don't know if I saved her life or endangered it further by pulling her back. When the train passed, it revealed a pickup truck with an orange beacon light on the roof idling on the next track. A man stepped out of the truck and walked over to us. "Was that you two on the tracks as the train passed?" "Yeah, why?" "I just got a radio call from the driver. He thought he hit you guys. I wasn't sure if I was coming to pick up bodies or what." "No, we're okay." "You'd think he would have arrested us, or at least suggested we move off the tracks, but he just said, 'All right,' and drove off." Iris recently told me that she still has that flattened penny. As beautiful as the city of Santa Barbara is, my years living there were the darkest of my life. The small-town vibe of everyone knowing each other was offset by the I-don't-give-a-fuck hardcore surfer attitude. I was surrounded by rich kids getting wasted and crashing the new cars their parents had bought them. And after accidentally walking in on a girl shooting up in the bathroom at a house party, I became keenly aware of the heroin scene lurking all around me. And of course, there was Raymond. He had a frightening reputation, and his family was somehow involved in the Mexican mafia. But he was generally nice to me until one night at Eagle Billiards. Raymond and I were shooting pool when he suddenly decided we were playing for Pink Slips. At the time, he had a souped-up 1960s Buick, and I had a beat-up Mustang. So I stood to gain more than he did, but I also knew there was no way I would ever drive away in his car. No one got the best of Raymond. I was either going to lose the game and lose my car, or win the game and get an ass kicking. I tried to talk my way out of it. No dice. All I could do was play my best and hope a tornado hit the pool hall before it was over. I held my breath after every shot. If my car and my ass hadn't been on the line, I might have noticed the crowd gathering around us. I was a decent pool player, but so was Raymond. The game couldn't have been closer if it had been scripted. It came down to an empty table and a lonely eight ball. Raymond took a shot and missed to a chorus of "Oh!" from the crowd. He didn't leave me with an easy angle. My heart was racing and my hands were shaking as I drew back the cue. Raymond stared into me from the other side of the table, trying to throw my concentration. I pocketed the eight ball. Raymond advanced on me. I dropped my cue and backed my way around the table, trying to play it cool. "Forget about it, dude. I don't want your fucking car." "Good, because I'm not giving it to you." He broke off his pursuit. I thought I was in the clear, but from then on, Raymond and I couldn't be in the same room without him vengefully glaring at me. It seemed like only a matter of time before I would become his next victim. One night at a party, Raymond started fucking with me. He said something about how I wasn't man enough to take his car, and then tried to slap me. I turned my head away and only caught his fingertips, but it was clear that Santa Barbara was no longer big enough for the both of us. After our next tour, I moved back to my parents' house in L.A. The worst part about this dark era was that I dragged Iris into it. Long after we broke up, she told me Raymond came over to the NoFX house one day while I was out. I don't know if he knew I wouldn't be home, but when Iris told him I wasn't there, he forced himself inside and tried to rape her. Thankfully, she was able to fight him off, struggling until Raymond got tired of her and left. Given that Raymond was later convicted of raping several other girls in town, I guess she got off lucky. It might be unfair for me to blame myself for putting Iris in that situation just because I brought her to Santa Barbara and into that circle of friends, but I was crushed to hear about what she had been through. And I will always have to wonder if Raymond's attack might have been prevented if I'd just taken his goddamn pink slip and the beating that came with it.
Chapter 29. Mike. Iris wasn't able to fight Raymond off. That's just what she told Melvin. She told me the whole story, and you can imagine how horrible the reality was. She said she didn't want to tell Melvin what really happened because he would confront Raymond, and Raymond would kill him. She was probably right. I promised I wouldn't tell him, and I never did, until now. Sorry, Mel. Sorry, Iris.
Chapter 30. Smelly. I injected cocaine the first time I ever tried it. Usually the progression is snorting, smoking, and then shooting. But like everything else in my life, I did it backwards. After I rejoined NoFX, Melvin and his new girlfriend, Iris, moved to Santa Barbara. We rented an old California craftsman house with a few other friends. It was the classic punk pad, with keggers and weird people and plenty of drugs in and out all the time. Raymond came by one night with a syringe full of coke for himself, and I insisted on trying it. He shot me up, and it hit all my senses. It tasted like ether. It smelled like model glue, and my ears whistled like a tea kettle, and my brain clenched inside my skull. Then the adrenaline kicked in. I felt like the Millennium Falcon jumping into light speed. And then it was over. I mean, I was still high, but the big roller coaster drop only lasts a few seconds. And then you want to go again. You have to go again, and again, and again, and again, and again. I probably did 6 or 7 shots that night, probably within that hour. And that's nothing. Over the next year or so, there were nights when I would do 200 shots in a row. Nights when I had no veins left and blood leaking out of my arms. Nights when I was crawling on the floor in my room, crying and scouring the carpet for pieces of white dust that might be injectable. Nights when I was panicking and stabbing myself with a needle, digging for veins, insisting that there must be a way to get another shot in me. And cocaine wasn't even my biggest problem. About a week or two after my first shot of coke, Raymond dropped by the NoFX house with some heroin. He needed a place to shoot up, and I told him he could use our place as long as he got me high as well. He unwrapped this little black marble of earwax and then went into the bathroom, not to shoot up, but to throw up. Heroin has a very particular smell to it. When you're a junkie going through withdrawals, or if you haven't done heroin in years, the smell can be a physical trigger. Nausea sets in hard and makes you want to puke. To this day, I'll walk down the street and an odor will waft out of a shop that reminds me of the smell of heroin and my guts just churn. In fact, just picturing that little black marble in my head and thinking about the smell is enough to make me feel sick right now. Excuse me for a second. Raymond finished vomiting and cooked up the shot. As soon as he injected himself, he stabilized. He asked me if I really wanted some, and I said yes. After all, he had made it look like so much fun. Honestly, I didn't see what all the fuss was about. It was the opposite of shooting coke, less of a rush, more like slipping into a warm jacuzzi. It hit me in the back of my knees, worked its way through my stomach, and went up to my head, which suddenly felt like it weighed 100 pounds. Every muscle in my body decompressed all at once as I drifted in and out of consciousness. It was pleasantly mellow, but I didn't see how anyone could crave the sensation all the time, and within an hour, I was out in the driveway throwing up. I didn't love it, I didn't hate it, I don't know why I even wanted to do it a second time. I could have easily walked away and never thought about it again. But my friend was always doing it, so it was always around. It was a nice tranquil high, so I gave it a few more tries. Within 5 months, I was completely strung out and my life would never be the same. As if all the vomiting hadn't been enough of a warning, I should have at least heeded Raymond's words when he first shot me up. I'll never forget them. There we were in the bathroom. I tied myself off, pretending like I knew what I was doing while he cooked up the shot for me. He found the vein, slid the needle under my skin. Just before he slammed down the plunger, he looked me dead in the eye and told me my future. Welcome to hell.
Chapter 31, Dave. Dave? Dave's not here. This is Tommy Chong. I was always a shy kid. I always felt self-conscious and out of place, even in my own home. My two older brothers were separated from me by more than a half a decade in age, and they were both so good at baseball that they nearly went pro, while I couldn't get to first base with a GPS. When I was 7, my parents split up, and my brothers both went to live with my dad, while I ended up with my mom. I was more or less raised as an only child. My friend Tommy Niemeyer was like a surrogate brother. We grew up in Oxnard, California together, and discovered punk rock together when we found a flyer for a Stiff Little Fingers concert. It wasn't only my first punk show, it was the first time I'd ever seen a live band perform. We stood in the back at first, but as people started pogoing and slamming, we couldn't fight the urge to jump right in the middle of it all. From then on, both of us dug deep into the punk racks at the local record store trying to chase the buzz. Soon after, Tommy's family moved away from Oxnard, and I was crushed. I was isolated again. Being a punk in the early 80s was alien enough in big cities like L.A., but in a town like Oxnard, famous more for its Strawberry Festival than its music scene, it was social leprosy. But I wasn't the only kid in the area getting bored of his Led Zeppelin albums. I was a regular at the Endless Wave Skate Park, where I met Mark and Bob from Aggression, before they were in Aggression, and Jamie and Gilbert Hernandez, who were publishing a now-classic comic book, Love and Rockets. Jamie and Gilbert had a brother, Ishmael, who was starting a band called Dr. No with another new friend named Kyle Tutcher. I don't know if you can call 6 or 7 guys a scene, but it was something. And it meant that Ishmael and Kyle didn't have a lot of options when it came to finding a second guitarist for Dr. No, so they invited me to join. I had taken 2 guitar lessons and then quit, learning by ear while listening to my Circle Jerks and Black Flag records. The only show I'd ever played with Dr. No was outdoors at the Oak Grove Park in Camarillo. By that point, punks from nearby towns like Ventura and Point Hueneme had joined forces with the punks in Oxnard. Ishmael dubbed our growing scene Nardcore. We had 50 people at our little outdoor gig in the park, which was a pretty respectable turnout. I, however, was shivering like a motherfucker. It didn't matter that the crowd was made up entirely of our friends. The stage fright was overpowering. I had already been using alcohol to abate my shyness and social anxiety, so of course I leaned on booze to calm my nerves at the show. Unfortunately, it worked. The show went smoothly as far as I can remember, but after the amount I drank, I don't remember much, and a destructive habit was born. I loved playing guitar. I loved the idea of being in a band. But after a lifetime of being ignored, I found that alcohol was the only way I could deal with all those eyes suddenly staring into me. My tenure in Dr. No only lasted a few months. I have a short attention span. If I hang out with the same people long enough, I get bored and jump ship, no matter how good things are going. I started a band called M.I.A., and spent several months playing in local shows and occasionally getting confused for a band from Vegas with the same name. When I got bored with that, I joined a group called Ground Zero, recorded a 7-inch, and left after 4 months. Then I heard local legend Stalag 13 was looking for a new guitarist, and I joined them for a record-breaking year and a half. We played often and recorded a full-length album, but I got into one too many fights with Ron, the singer, because he was militantly straight-edge, and I was militantly not. After that, I was directionless. No band, no job, and living at my mom's. But before reality and depression had time to set in, I got a call from my friend Matt. He had a band called Rat Pack, and he wanted me to join. He had a job for me at a screen printing place, and he had an apartment behind his dad's chiropractic office in Santa Barbara where I could stay. Things went well for a year or so. Rat Pack started as a punk band, then we went metal for a while, and then I decided I was bored with metal and wanted to play punk again. Like I said, short attention span. I walked into a fancy music store on State Street one day and saw an ad that read NoFX looking for a punk rock guitar player. That's all it took. Every band I was ever in eventually hit an expiration date. Rat Packs had just arrived.
Chapter 32, Mike. You know that saying, be careful what you wish for, you might just get it? We wished for a second guitar player